This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Live and Learn with me, Lim Suan. Law and Behold is a series aimed at improving constitutional literacy among Malaysians, done in collaboration with the Malaysian Bar and the University of Malaya's Faculty of Law. In our sixth episode, we'll be discussing provisions on equality and affirmative action in the federal constitution. Joining me are Emeritus Professor Dato' Dr. Syed Salim Farooqi, Professor of Constitutional Law at the University of Malaya, as well as Surendra Anand, Co-Chairperson of the Bar Council's Constitutional Law Committee, to discuss these provisions and how these have transcended into everyday life. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
So today we are discussing equality, and the main provision in the Constitution is Article 8, right?
Yes, yes.
Yep. Can you walk me through it?
Well, before I say anything about the Constitution, the Article 8, can I just give a preliminary statement? And that is this, that the ideal of equality before the law is one of the greatest ideals in our civilization, but it's one of the most difficult. The reason for that is that inequality is a pervasive and persistent reality everywhere in the world. May I put it bluntly? Nature's sovereign law is subordination and dependence on exploitation. In nature, big fish eat small fish, and that's natural. But of course, constitutional law cannot tie itself to existentialist realities. It has to hitch itself to stars. And I think that's where the Constitution comes in. Article 8, Clause 1 beautifully says, all persons are equal before the law and entitled to the equal protection of the law. We'll notice that it says all persons. It doesn't say all citizens. All persons are equal before the law, entitled to the equal protection of the law. Article 8, Clause 2 strengthens the ideal of equality by forbidding discrimination in 5 specific areas. Many people believe that means discrimination is not permissible in those 5 areas, but it's permissible elsewhere. I don't think so. I think the general rule is equality before the law and equal protection of the law. But especially in those 5 areas, discrimination is not permissible.
Yep, I think just to expand on what Prof had to say, when we look at 8.1, basically, I'm just going to read it out very quickly. All persons are equal before the law and entitled to the equal protection of the law. And what that basically means is that whenever you want to treat someone differently, if you want to treat a group of people differently, you must have a reasonable and objective reason for treating that person differently. But one of the main misconceptions on equality, which I think is important, is that people always think of equality as treating people in the same manner in all scenarios. But that's not necessarily what equality means. What equality truly means is to achieve an equal result. And sometimes to achieve an equal result, we need to treat different people differently. Now, just to provide a very, very simple example, when we have facilities, let's say a bus, for example, and you provide for a stairwell or a staircase to get up to the bus, now, what about people who are disabled? You will need to provide a ramp for disabled people. Now, in that scenario, it is a scenario of treating 2 class of people differently, but it is necessary to ensure that there is an equal result. Now, this would apply across the board to vulnerable groups. This could be indigenous people, children, women, people or groups that need to be treated specially or differently in order to achieve an equal result at the end of the day. And this is where the concept of what you call affirmative action comes into the picture. Because in order to ensure equality in result, you will need to treat a group and accord them with special and certain additional rights to ensure equality. So I think that's an important concept that maybe Prof can expand a bit on as well.
Yeah, I totally agree. Formal equality is not enough. It has to be functional. People must ultimately receive what is their entitlement under the law. So if someone is left behind, or if any group is left behind for whatever reason, then I think the state has a duty to provide, as far as possible, a level playing field.
So race is one of the grounds of non-discrimination and under Article 8.2, right? And from what I've read, Article 8.2 also provides that there can't be any discrimination on the grounds listed except as expressly authorized. So, and this referred to the provisions on affirmative action that you mentioned earlier. So what are the provisions of affirmative action in the Constitution?
I think I'll just give a brief introduction. I think the relevant one in this sense is Article 153, which accords certain special rights to the Malay and the natives from the states of Sabah and Sarawak, which I think Prof will go into detail a bit more. But just to be clear on this, before Prof goes into the language of the provision, I think it's important to understand why that provision was put in the Constitution. And for that, I'm sorry to bore the audience, but a bit of a historical recap is necessary. So as I think most people know, the Constitution was drafted by a commission called the Reed Commission. And when they drafted the Constitution, they took into account representations from various people. Now, Article 153 on the special rights was one of the most contentious areas. And we need to understand at that point, you had the MIC representing the interests of the Indian community, the MCA for the Chinese, and UMNO for the Malays. So it was a coherent process of tolerance and accommodation between different ethnic groups. That's important.
Mm-hmm.
But number two, when it came to 153, it was the alliance or the then Barisan position that was needed for the protection of the Malays because they were the original sons of the soil. So as far as the alliance was concerned, they said that affirmative action was required because Malays were the original people of the land. That was their position, and that's in their memorandum, and I'm reading it in verbatim. Now, when the Reed Commission considered the various memorandums, they came to a different conclusion, and I'm going to read from their own document, their own words. So this is why the Reed Commission thought 153 was necessary. This is their words. It is required as the Malays would be at a serious and unfair disadvantage compared with other communities if they were suddenly withdrawn. Commission said, with the integration of the various communities into a common nationality in which we trust will gradually come about, the need for these preferences will gradually disappear. Our recommendations are made on the footing that the Malays should be assured that the present position will continue for a substantial period, but that in due course, the present preference should be reduced and should ultimately cease so as there should be no discrimination between races or communities. This was the thinking. And obviously, after that, the Constitution or the draft went through certain changes. It's called a white paper. It's another commission. And again, it was reiterated in the white paper that the preferences in Article 153 should be reviewed after 15 years by the Yang Dipertuan Agong. Now, ultimately, when you look at 153 itself, which Prof will explain, this purpose was actually reiterated by the federal court in one of the decision in the 1970s. And this is what the federal court says. These provisions cannot be questioned and are necessary to assist the less advanced or fortunate in light of the conditions prevailing in the country at the time of independence. It may take time, certainly not in our generation, for the provisions to become redundant. So the point I'm trying to make in all of this is if you look at it from a historical perspective, it was very, very clear that Article 153 was introduced because the particular community was at that time at a position of disadvantage to ensure that the community would be brought on an equal playing field with the other communities.
Mm-hmm.
And that is in line with equality because as me and Prof explained earlier, it's about substantive or functional equality. That is to ensure true equality between all communities. But I think the contents of Article 153 and to which categories it apply, Prof can explain that further.
Yeah, actually, even Malay leaders like Tun Ismail are on record for saying that there will come a time when the Malays themselves will want to give up these handicaps, if I may call them. So I agree with you that the spirit behind Article 153 was a spirit of affirmative action, not a spirit of apartheid or racial discrimination. The idea was to bring up a community that had, for various historical reasons, fallen behind. Now, Article 153 is largely misunderstood or misinterpreted as if it applies only to the special position of the Malays. First of all, please bear in mind, it doesn't use the word privileges. It says special position. Also, it says special position of the Malays and the natives of Sabah, Sarawak and the legitimate interest of other communities. So no one was left out in 153, actually. Legitimate interests of other communities. May I also point out to you, when it comes to special position of Malays, the definition of a Malay in Article 160, Clause 2 is not based on race.
Mm-hmm.
The most amazing thing in 160, Clause 2 is that an ethnic group is defined in a non-ethnic way. A person is a Malay if he is Muslim, if he follows Malay adat, Malay custom, if he speaks the Bahasa Melayu habitually. And it doesn't say, and if he's of Malay racial stock, it doesn't say that. It says, and if he is either born in Malaya or Singapore on or before Merdeka Day, or he's descended from one parent who may be born in Singapore or in Malaya on or before Merdeka Day. So it is more like a cultural concept rather than a racial concept. And of course, when you say natives of Sabah, Sarawak, natives can belong to many, many races, many, many religions. There are natives who are Muslim, there are natives who are not. So basically, Article 153 is broad-based. In West Malaysia, it's not based on race. Mm-hmm. In Sabah, Sarawak, it's not based on race or religion. It is more a cultural concept. Also, please bear in mind, Article 153 is limited to four areas only. It's not across the board. The four areas are employment in the public services. Secondly, permits, licenses issued by the federal government. Thirdly, scholarships and other such facilities. And fourthly, post-secondary education. Article 153 does not anywhere provide for things like 10% discount for houses, which is more of an administrative practice, perhaps out of lack of knowledge of 153's limited scope. Also, 153 clearly says that if a person has an office or a scholarship or a facility or a permit already held, you cannot deprive him of that in order to assist the Malays or the natives of Sabah, Sarawak. Article 153 also says no monopolies in any profession can be created. Article 153 also says that it does not derogate from Article 136. Mm-hmm. And what does 136 say? It says no discrimination in the public services on grounds of race. So if you put 153, which allows quotas and reservations, and you put 136 together, Tun Sufyan, our former Lord President, says, what it means is this, that at entry point, quotas and reservations are permitted. But once a person is in the public service already, there should be no discrimination. It should be merit-based. So all in all, what I wish to say is this, that Article 153 was meant to be a piece of affirmative action, what could be called protective discrimination. John Rawls, the great jurisprudential philosopher, called affirmative action just inequality. Mm-hmm. Just inequality. Beautiful words. So those who are left behind for whatever reason must be helped. But I think Article 153 was also conscious that the legitimate interest of other communities must be preserved. I also want to point out to you, 153 is only one of the provisions which is an exception. There are many other exceptions in our constitution and in many other constitutions around the world.
You mentioned our constitution. So what are the other exceptions in our constitution?
Would you believe that I've got a list of about 18 or 19 of them? That's a very long list. Very long list. Well, first of all, this is not in the constitution, but mm-hmm. this is the general reality. There is something called structural injustice. Mm-hmm. In other words, the institution or the law or the procedure is such that it tends to favor some over the other. All citizens are allowed to go to the courts. We're all allowed to have legal representation, Article 5, Clause 3. But if someone has no money, and let us say legal aid is not available, how does he get equal justice in the courts? So the whole system of justice, the way it is built, basically favors the rich over the poor. Unless the poor is qualifying for legal aid or advice, there are lawyers with large hearts who are prepared to take up their case. The adversarial system basically means the judge doesn't participate. He listens to both sides. But sometimes one side has a dream team defending it. The other side is underrepresented. Mm-hmm. So I would call that structural injustice. There are scores of such situations where the institution is built on prejudices. Citizenship laws often give preference to descent from a male, not from a female. The National Land Code gives ownership of land to those who have a title. But wait a minute, the Orang Asli, they don't have titles, but their generations have lived there. The souls of their ancestors roam the forest. They feel it's their land. But under the torrent system that we practice, Orang Asli does not own the land. At best, what the court says, oh, they own the usufruct, the fruit, the vegetable on the land, but not the land itself. I think the National Land Code is structurally unjust. Citizenship laws require children to be registered on birth. Looks very, very fair. Actually, it's structurally unjust because those in the hinterland, far away, sometimes single mothers, mm-hmm. full-time farmers or laborers, they deliver in the afternoon, next morning, they are working. They don't get to register their child. So no birth cert, No birth certificate means at age 6 he can't go to school. At age 12 he can't get an IC. Now, there is some structural injustice. So that's the first point I want to make to you. Every legal system suffers from structural injustices. If I work with my hand and you work with your head, you're bound to get 10 to 20 times, 30 times higher salary than me. But really, what's the moral basis for that? You look at our system, how the salaries, top civil servants take back as much as 200,000 ringgit per month. Not in terms of salary, but in terms of allowances and other things. Now, please don't get me wrong. I'm not jealous. What I'm saying is there are those with the minimum salary about 1,000 or 1,100. Forget the private sector. These are structural injustices. Very quickly then, Article 153, special position of Malays and the natives of Sabah, Sarawak. Malay Reserves, Article 89. But let me quickly point out to you, this is again a fairly balanced article. It says no non-Malay land shall be taken over for a Malay reserve. It also says, and if a certain amount of land is reserved for Malay reserves, an equivalent amount shall be opened up for general alienation. So that was Article 89. Then, of course, Islam is the religion of the Federation, which gives to Muslims very large number of advantages. So I can preach my religion to Surain, but he cannot preach his religion to me because of Article 11, Clause 4, and many other such advantages. MPs, judges, foreign diplomats have privileges and immunities. There are special courts for the Malay rulers. The government, in the Government Proceedings Act and the Public Authorities Protection Act, enjoys a lot of advantages. If I sue you in contract, I've got 6 years. If I sue the government, I've got only 36 months. So the government enjoys special privileges. Sabah, Sarawak have special rights over the other states. Adat for Malays is allowed. For the natives of Sabah, Sarawak is allowed. But the customs of the non-Malays has been abolished now. Orang Asli under Article 8, Clause 5 have a special position. Surain correctly pointed out, reasonable classification is allowed. So lawyers can have Legal Profession Act. Doctors can have Medical Act. So this is reasonable classification. In income tax, in labor law categories, there are several categories. Electoral constituencies, our constitution says, can have different populations. So if one electoral constituency has 20,000 and another one has 150,000 voters, obviously 20 votes in one area are equal to 120 votes in the other. Gender bias is prevalent. Last session you had about this private sector seems to be exempt from the constitution, or so they think. In our view, the constitution should apply in the private sector as well. Beatrice Fernandez was dismissed from mass simply because she got pregnant. And when she went to the court and said, that's gender discrimination, the federal court sided with mass and said, no, this is private sector, it's not government employment, and therefore she can be dismissed. Religious institutions and offices can be reserved for people of that religion. Residence prerequisite to appointments in the state for some jobs. Article 145 gives to the Attorney General very vast power to transfer cases laterally or vertically. And finally, the Malay Regiment. So these are 18 to 19 exceptions. And obviously, Article 8 equality is unsurpassed in its beauty. But the contradictions, the exceptions are monumental.
Mm-hmm. I've been speaking to Emeritus Professor Dato' Dr. Shad Salim Faruqi, Professor of Constitutional Law at University of Malaya, as well as Surendra Anand, Co-Chairperson of the Bar Council's Constitutional Law Committee, for our Law and Behold series. We've been discussing the concepts of equality and affirmative action in the federal constitution. We'll be back after a short break. You're listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture with me, Lim Soo Ann. You're listening to our Law and Behold series, which is aimed at improving constitutional literacy among Malaysians. It is done in collaboration with the Malaysian Bar, as well as the University of Malaya's Faculty of Law. With me in the studio today are Emeritus Professor Dato' Dr. Shad Salim Faruqi, as well as lawyer Surendra Anand. We're discussing the principles of non-discrimination and affirmative action. So you mentioned the private sector, and that has always been a point of contention for many, especially because so many Malaysians do work in the private sector. A lot of our activities are carried out in the private sector. There's a lot of discrimination that people argue are happening in the private sector. But would all this... So you mentioned the Beatrice Fernandez case that was not considered as discrimination under Article 8.2. But I mean, today we still see a lot more. How does that fit in into our principle of equality?
I think just going back to basics for a moment and then how we understand rights as it is, when we talk about rights, not just equality, any right, we often think about the relationship between us and the government.
Mm-hmm.
Because naturally, the government is the power holder. And normally, the government is the one that governs a lot of the relationships. But if you look at the language of the rights in the Constitution, all it says is that we are accorded certain rights.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't really say who gives us that rights, who should be protecting those rights, and who can take away those rights. But it's very clear that we are given rights.
Right.
Now, if you read the language just as it is, it should apply to everyone, not just the government, but also the private sector. But now, just going back to basics, I'm going to use another right because I think it's a clearer example. Right to life. At the very basic of right to life is the right to exist physically. Now, let's say the simple scenario is that we always think, well, if that's the case, the government can't kill me. And that's always where we're confining ourselves to. Now, let's say if a private person kills me, does that mean that the government can sit by and do nothing? No. What the government needs to do is it needs to ensure that there are measures to prevent people from killing one another, number one. And if it happens, the government needs to ensure that it's investigation, prosecution, to ensure that the perpetrator is put to justice. Now, let me just apply this simple basic concept to equality. Yes, the negative side of the coin is the government cannot discriminate and the government must treat all equally.
Mm-hmm.
But if in the private sector there is discrimination, at the very least, the government has an obligation to prevent that from happening. And this is where anti-discrimination and equality laws come into the picture. So my view is that Article 8 imposes an obligation on the government to enact laws or to enact any other form of policy or social action to ensure that there is no discrimination in the workplace. And a lot of countries actually have this. So for example, there are a lot of cases in Europe where females wear the burqa or the hijab.
Mm-hmm.
And the employees will say, you can't wear this. It's against our dress code, for example. They can actually file a complaint in the court to challenge that particular treatment or policy. And in most cases, normally, there will have to be accommodation between someone's religious practice, for example, and what the employment requires. So is it really necessary to ban someone from wearing a religious attire? Is it absolutely necessary? That is a balancing question. But the point is, right now, we don't have that sort of mechanism here in Malaysia because we have taken a very simplistic approach that, well, if you're going to be in the private sector, Article 8 doesn't apply,
mm-hmm.
which I think shouldn't be the case.
Yeah, I totally disagree with the view that Article 8 doesn't apply in the private sector. I am in line with Suren. Article 4 says this constitution is the supreme law of the Federation. It doesn't say supreme law in the public sector. It's the supreme law of the Federation. Now, may I give you one or two examples here to illustrate and to back up what Suren was saying. Article 6 abolishes slavery. Now, don't tell me in the private sector there can be slavery.
Mm-hmm.
Article 13 gives a right to property. It's not just property against the government, it's property against everyone. Article 11 gives freedom of religion. Surely the employer cannot prevent an employee from practicing his or her religion. Article 5 says no liberty shall be deprived. Surely my employer cannot just lock me up, prevent me from exercising my liberty. So clearly, many of the articles of the Constitution, like articles against slavery, detention, property, religion, obviously they apply to everyone. They apply in the public sector, private sector. Second point I want to raise is this. Can a private employment contract violate EPF law? Can it violate the Industrial Relations Act? Can it violate the SOXO law? Obviously, the answer is it cannot. So if a private contract cannot violate an ordinary law, how can a private contract violate the Constitution, which is even a higher law? And thirdly, in jurisprudence, we talk about a hierarchy of laws,
mm-hmm.
with the Constitution at the apex. The Constitution then regulates every rule in the legal system. Whether the rule is made by the parliament, whether made by an employer, the attitude of, for example, the jurist Hans Kelsen is, a contract between you and me, let's say you are my employer, a contract between you and me is a piece of delegated legislation under the Employment Act.
Mm-hmm.
So parliament passed the Employment Act. You and I now have entered into a regulation, a rule, rules, and it's not a private sector thing. It's actually a piece of a delegated legislation binding you and me under the Employment Act. So I totally agree with Suren. The idea that the Constitution does not apply in the private sector is bad legal philosophy, bad constitutionalism. And I would add to what he was saying. I think we clearly need a Race Relations Act or an Equal Pay Act or a Gender Discrimination Act to forbid discrimination in the private sector. But we can allow some exceptions. So, for example, in England, if you have an establishment which is less than five persons, then maybe the Act doesn't apply. The cook I hire for my house, the driver I hire to drive my car, maybe I can choose according to race or religion or gender or whatever. But when you serve the public, you're running a restaurant, a laundromat, you're having a hotel, you're employing workers, you've got to treat everyone with dignity.
Another issue that, I mean, I just want to ask, there was a recent survey that was carried out, found, you know, many Malaysians face discrimination when they were trying to rent homes. So that would fall under the private sector?
Yeah, arguably. But to be fairly honest, it's a very grey area. And I will admit that from the start, that what I'm going to say might not represent the majority view or the common view. Mm-hmm. I think there are a lot of views, but this is what my thinking is. It's a very fine line when it comes to things like this. Some would call it preference. Some might say it's discrimination. But let's be clear on at least what the law is. Equality basically means, as I said earlier, treating everyone the same. And if you're going to treat someone differently, I'm not saying you can't, you can, but there has to be a reasonable reason of why you're doing that. So let's take the rentals, for example. Now, if the purpose of me, let's say, not wanting to rent out to a particular race or only wanting to rent out to a race, let's say it's because I don't want certain type of food to be cooked in my place. Now, if I articulate my advertisement as that let's say I don't want a certain type of food cooked, that's fine. I think that's justifiable.
Mm-hmm.
But if I'm going to then say a particular race is not allowed, full stop, I would think that that is not allowed because you are singling out a race, like it or not.
Mm-hmm.
So often the problem is how we articulate it. And the case is always because certain attributes, physical or otherwise, are normally, people tend to normally attribute it to a particular race. So for example, in a job advert, Chinese only. Sometimes the reason why they put it is not because they only want Chinese, but because let's say they want Chinese speaking employees. And that is justifiable in certain scenarios. But because it so happens that it's normally the Chinese community that normally speaks Mandarin, Hokkien or whatever, that it's being articulated as a Chinese-only ad. So that's where I think the difference is. So if you're going to treat someone differently for a home rental or for anything solely because that person belongs to a certain race group, I think that is wrong. But if you want to treat someone differently, let's say because you want a certain spoken language or you want people in the household to act in a certain way, I think that's fine. But articulate it or state it in that way and not, don't always try to link it back to race.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where the problem is in Malaysia, because we always tend to attribute certain things to a particular race. That's where the slip of the hand always comes in, I think.
Yeah, as Suren said, if you are treating someone differently, in law we will say if you are indulging in classification, categorization, then that classification must meet at least three or four criteria. Number one, it must be intelligible. Clearly, you must separate one group from the other. Secondly, you must be able to distinguish reasonably one group from the other. The differentiation must have a rational relation with the object sought to be achieved. So I'm renting a house and let us say I am a very strict vegetarian. So I say vegetarians only. Now, that could be a rational classification. But as Suren said, you say Muslims only or Chinese only. I think that is not reasonably intelligible.
Mm-hmm.
That is, and finally, the fourth criterion is, courts have elaborated, whether something is arbitrary or a rational classification is for the courts to decide.
So, I mean, going back to looking at the government, so one of the main issues that we faced recently was that when the government wanted to ratify ICERT, the Convention to Eliminate Racial Discrimination, There was a lot of backlash from people. Some of the arguments that emerged, for example, was that it would impact upon the affirmative action provisions that we have for the Malay community, that it would weaken the position of Islam in the country, or that it would erode the power of the Malay rulers. I mean, if we had ratified ICED, how would ICED have impacted the laws in Malaysia?
I'll just give a very general view first. I don't think it would have had a very big impact on the laws in Malaysia for this simple reason. ICED is in fact an example of affirmative action, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at one of the articles in the ICED, and I'm going to read it just to be very clear. Special measures taken for the sole purpose of securing adequate advancement of certain racial or ethnic groups or individuals, requiring such protection as may be necessary in order to ensure such groups or individuals enjoy equal protection of human rights and fundamental freedoms. So, in essence, the ICED actually allows special treatment, affirmative action to a particular racial group mm-hmm. to ensure that they're on a level playing field. And earlier, if you recall, I was reading out certain historical excerpts on Article 153. That was what 153 is for. Now, this is where I think the slight problem is. When you look at the wordings of 153,
mm-hmm.
it doesn't expressly contemplate temporariness. It seems to suggest a certain degree of permanence. There is no, for example, express provision for a periodic time review, as what was contemplated by the founders, for example. So while the white paper said it should be reviewed after 15 years, that's not reflected in the actual provision. So that is, I think, where the slight problem is. But let's say if we were to ratify the ICED now, and if we can reasonably justify that the Malays and the natives of Sabah and Sarawak still require affirmative action to ensure a level playing field, I don't think there's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
But if it gets to a point where there is no need for affirmative action anymore on an objective basis, then there might be an issue as to whether we still need 153. So yes, there is a slight problem, but I don't think it is as big as it's being played out.
Yes, I think also that ICED had no adverse implication for the position of the rulers. It had no adverse implication for Islam as the religion of the Federation. With all due respect to those who raised these arguments, I think these were terribly manufactured threats, manufactured threat. They are not real. But I agree with Suren. The main issue of 153 and ICERD was this, that ICERD allows affirmative action, but not as a permanent feature. Whereas in 153, there is no time limit. But at the same time, 153 also doesn't state anywhere that this shall be forever. So I think the two can go together. If 153 is employed to help the weak, if 153 is employed truly in the spirit of affirmative action, if 153 is not abused by the elite to enrich themselves, then I think there is no problem between 153 and ICERD. May I point out to you, not only Malaysia, India has tremendous provisions in its constitution for helping what they call the scheduled castes. Even in the USA, during the days of John Kennedy, there was this idea of affirmative action, and not only women, but ethnic groups who had fallen behind were to be given treatment, special treatment in terms of admission to universities. And I can say this to you from legal philosophy. Affirmative action is definitely regarded by most legal philosophers as part of the principle of equality, but equality in the long range. Some had been disadvantaged in the past. To assist them to catch up with the others, you need to give them some handicaps. So there's not that much of a problem between ICERD and Article 153.
Mm-hmm. So just to round up, I think you mentioned some of this earlier. What do you think are the improvements, especially in the law, for example, or policies that can be made to improve the limitations or loopholes that may exist in the Constitution?
So I think just to wrap up the discussion, I think we've been talking a lot about the laws, and I think that's partly where the problem is. We tend to always look at the laws as a solution. And I think when it comes to equality, my humble view, I don't think enacting laws is or should be the primary solution. It is a solution, but I don't think it's the main solution. Equality and treating people equally has a lot to do with our attitude and our thinking, our subconscious bias towards certain things. This is something that has to be incorporated from young. So classic example, I went to a government school. Fortunate enough, my government school had quite an equal proportion of every race.
Mm-hmm.
So even when I was seven, when I went to standard one, there were already racial things being thrown at me, like you Balik India and all that. But as we grew, as we mixed among the different races, we started to accept the differences that we had. And eventually we treated each other equally because we understood and we accepted those differences. But right now, if you look at the government schools, for example, you will find that there is only, let's say, only one particular race. Then you have Chinese schools, Tamil schools, private schools. There is really no mixing around and tolerance and how to understand our differences, race or religion-wise, in schools anymore. If you look at it now, it's, in fact, I would think it's quite divisive in nature, our education. You have, for example, the Muslim students going to do a lot of the Islamic studies. The non-Muslim students will then study Pendidikan Moral. So they're spending a lot of time away from each other. And this is why when they step out into the adult life, the working circle, you're going to end up with a lot of discriminative views and things like that. So laws, yes, it's sort of forced on the people, but is it really going to make a change when it comes to, let's say, home rentals, ads and all that? I don't really think so. What you need to do is change the mindset.
Mm-hmm.
That has to start from young. So you really, really, we really need to change the education system and how we approach it from the youngest age possible. And I think that's where the real change needs to be.
I want to add something else, and that is this, that the whole discussion, including our discussion today on Article 8 equality, has looked at it primarily from the ethnic or religious lens.
Mm-hmm.
I want to make this request that actually we need to de-ethnicize Article 8 equality. Article 8 actually is a fantastic article with multiple functions and vast civilizing potential. Equality doctrine is not only about equality amongst races, religions, and genders. It's a generic provision. For example, Article 8 can be employed to challenge any arbitrary laws, because if a law gives to a government official unlimited arbitrary power, he can treat like as unlike and unlike as alike. That law can be challenged. In many countries like the USA, even in Malaysia, actually, Justice Gopal Sriram has said that arbitrary powers are a total contradiction of the ideal of equality before the law. When it comes to fair procedures, equality before the law requires fair procedures. Equality before the law not only requires equal subjection of everyone to the law and equal justice, it also actually means such things as legal aid. In the USA, if in a criminal case a person is unrepresented, that's violation of equality before the law. So I just want to humbly request all our listeners on this point that Article 8 equality is not only about gender and race and religion. It's a generic provision with a tremendously civilizing influence. It is antithetical to arbitrary powers. So that's one thing I want to say. Secondly, Article 8 should not be looked at simply from the racial lens. We must look at it also from the point of view of structural injustices. So, for example, what I said to you earlier about citizenship giving preference to males. In Sabah, Sarawak, the status of a native is often dependent on your male descent rather than female descent. This cuts across races and religions. In the working sector, there are structural injustices. For example, I mentioned to you earlier how our salary system is such that between the top and the bottom, there is massive difference. So we need to look at structural injustices. Thirdly, we need to solve this problem of public sector and the private sector poisoning each other, the vicious circle that exists between the two. Number four, we need to distinguish between racism and racial consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
Racism is a very negative thing. You have prejudices against another race or religion or ethnic community. You want to bring them down. You want to keep them down. Racial consciousness is a positive thing whereby you want to undertake measures to help a group, not necessarily your own. For example, you and I may be wanting to work for the Orang Asli, even though we are not Orang Asli. I think racism is not justified. Of course, it's not justified. But racial consciousness is all right. You want to bring up a particular group. In this country, there is confusion. So people say, oh, we should not recognize this degree because this educational qualification, because that means the gap between X and Y races will remain very large. I don't think that's the right approach. I think the approach should be you try to bring up a particular group. By all means, everything possible, do. You don't have to try to keep anyone else down. And finally, Article 153 is primarily in the hands of politicians and civil servants. They have not worked it very well. I think because of their political enforcement of 153, a wide gap has developed between the promises of Article 153 and the performance on the ground. We need to bridge this gap between theory and reality. I humbly recommend an affirmative action board or some such body that could possibly administer Article 153 policies, create fair quotas, and give benefits, privileges, special advantages to people based on need. I think that would be a great, that would be consistent with the Constitution. At the same time, it would actually be in the spirit of our ideal, the great ideal of equality before the law and equal protection of the law.
You've been listening to Law and Behold, where I've been speaking to Emeritus Professor Dato' Dr. Shad Salim Faruqi, Professor of Constitutional Law at the University of Malaya, as well as Surendra Anand, Co-Chairperson of the Bar Council's Constitutional Law Committee, about equality and affirmative action in the federal constitution. If you've missed any part of this interview or any previous Live and Learn interviews, you can download the podcast on our website, on our BFM app, or on Spotify. This has been Live and Learn, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.